Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I guess I need to add into that drinkers as well, because we have a lot about drinks on today's program.
We
do. Starting with one of your favorites.
This is one of Peter's favorites.
Yes.
Our good friends at Michter's, who've been going back to producing bourbon whiskey in America since before the Whiskey Rebellion, or shortly afterwards, if it wasn't before, and then disappearing from sight for a while, and now within the last few years making a huge comeback. And a part of that huge comeback is a product just nicely released and just nicely sitting in our closet waiting for me to sip it a little bit at a time, a bourbon whiskey from Michter's, aged from 10 years minimum.
Product of two talented women, I might add.
Yeah, I forgot about that. exactly. And they'll explain their roles and all of the above. So let's turn it over to the girls.
Women, dear.
Peter gets the privilege of talking to not just one, but two masters in the distillation process for a American whiskey company called Michter's.
Which we love.
Which started out in Pennsylvania, then disappeared and reemerged in Kentucky. And the other privilege I have is I got to open a very special Michter's bourbon whiskey.
I got one sip. That's all I've had.
Which of you'd like to tell us? Well, we have Pam Heilerman and Andrea Wilson. And perhaps you can introduce yourselves by your various titles.
Yeah, and explain why this is so unusual, this expression, this 10-year bourbon that we got. It's so unusual that you did this jointly, the two of you, in your individual roles. Could you do that?
Well, this is Pam Heilman. I'm the master distiller and executive vice president here at Michter's. And I can talk a little bit to the 10-year, but to be honest, we did this expression the same way we do all of our expressions. We have a team here. It's a concerted effort on the part of the entire team to bring these expressions to fruition. Andrea, why don't you introduce yourself, Andrea, and your title so they know who you are.
Yeah, so I'm the master of maturation, so I am a supporting team member to Pam. I look after all of the aging cask, and that includes the air drying of the wood to meet our specifications, the toasting of the wood, the charring of the wood, the spirit entry filling the cask, the lay down of the cask into their warehousing, the warehousing environment, and then tracking, the temperature conditions, tracking the environment of the aging throughout the year, heat cycling, and all of that comes under my remit, and then helping to identify casks that are ready to be evaluated by the master distiller.
No wonder it's good.
Hold on a second.
So we have a lot of team members that are involved in the entire process.
Yeah, but hold up, everyone has their role. Hold up just a second.
We work together as a team, and obviously, as the master distiller, I have the ultimate say in what goes into that bottle. However, we all participate in tasting and in deciding, the properties and the characteristics of the particular product and whether we feel it meets the quality standards of a Michter's product.
Now, here's the question. Who would ordinarily do what Andrea does? And I've never heard of a master of maturation before. Does the master distiller do it?
It's a common title, from what I understand, in the Scotch industry.
Oh, okay, all right.
However, here at Michter's, because of Andrea's expertise in all of the wood science, Joe felt that it was the perfect role, and it fits her all of her experience to a T. So it's kind of a unique role, I think, here at Michter's, and maybe in the bourbon industry. It's not something people have been called, is master of maturation. But I think there are people that do those roles in different organizations. They may be called something different.
Right. Now, our first introduction to single barrel or small batch bourbon was actually with someone who I think you know very well, because you used to work with him, and that was Booker No.
Why are you laughing? Why are you laughing?
Well, Booker actually retired about 6 months prior to me starting at Beam, but I did get to work with him on a couple of small projects at the plant. I was a lowly supervisor, but meeting him was a great honor, and working with him was a great honor. He was a character in his own right, and a really larger than life figure.
No question about that.
And did you meet his wife?
Oh yes, she's a wonderful lady.
She's
wonderful.
Grand.
Yeah, we got a shipment of the used barrel chips to use in our barbecue.
Oh, did you? Wow, great. That's great.
It's great stuff, but it's really funny. Somebody at this testing, somebody asked Booker how frequently he tasted single barrel bourbon. He said every day.
Oh, yeah, I will. We do the same at Michter's. I mean, every day we're tasting something here. We're tasting barrels out of our warehouse every day. Andrea will acquire samples that are ready to be tasted and tested, and those are tested, and then we all sample. We all sit down and talk about what we're sampling.
Wow. Now, a question I asked Booker, and I know you're going to give me a different answer, because this is when we met him was probably 25 years ago.
Oh, dear.
And we asked him, we said, Scotch gets better every year, and the longer it's aged, the more you can sell it for. I said, why isn't anybody aging bourbon in the same way? Because back then, if you got 6 or 8 year old bourbon, that was it. No one was doing anything longer than that. Mm-hmm. Now that's clearly changing, I'd like you to react to what, if you like, Booker said and what I just reported to you, and say, has anything changed, or are you just being more experimental?
I think I'm going to let Andrea answer this as well, but I'll kind of state my opinion. Things have changed in the past 25 years. 25 years ago, people weren't interested in tasting aged products in the bourbon industry. Nobody was interested, and times have changed. I don't know that the products have changed all that much, but people are more aware of aged products, and we are, you know, obviously aging to a quality perfection. Andrea, do you want to talk to that as per wood science?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting topic, because I do think that just in general, consumers today are much more
savvy,
discovery oriented. You know, they want to experiment, they want to learn, they want to explore, they want to know who made the whiskey, why they made it, why they chose what they did, the ingredients they use. I just think that the whole idea of what a consumer is today is very different than what it was, you know, long ago. And I agree that once upon a time, you know, there wasn't a real value put on a whiskey that was 10 years old or 15 years old or 20 years old. In our case, we age for taste, and we're all about, you know, the quality of our products, and we're selecting our products to meet what we think the consumers will really enjoy, and we're trying to make the best American whiskey. So, you know, for example, our 10-year products aren't just 10 years old and we send them down the bottling line. Pam is adamant that she wants it to be a magnificent release, and we want it to have wow factor. And so that's what we really work hard on a team here, is select cask that we believe do have a wow factor, but we're not tied to what the age of that spirit is necessarily. Sure. It has to be a minimum of 10 to have 10 years old on the label. But, you know, we've had products in the bottle 12, 13, 15 years old, you know, in those bottles. And same thing with our 20-year expressions. But once upon a time, you know, nobody was interested in those. But today, we work really hard at wood science here. We're monitoring how the whiskey is actually chemically changing over time. We're monitoring how the sensory profile of time. And, you know, what it really comes down to is all the work that we put into aging our wood. We start with at least 18-month air-dried wood, so it sits outside in the yard. It naturally seasons. And what that does for us is it helps remove a lot of astringent characters, a lot of bitter characters in the wood that aren't great for making whiskey. So that's the first step for us. And then when it comes into the cooperage, we will actually toast the wood, which is actually heating it for a specified period of time. Which is typically a long time. You know, it's hours. It's not seconds like charring. The toasting process allows us to break down different flavor compounds in the wood that we can then extract directly into our product. So that's another thing that we do that really allows us to get the maximum out of the time that we're aging that product in the barrel.
Andrea. Where does all this come from? How do you get to know that you're supposed to know all this? And how do you become an expert in this?
Well, my family would probably say, oh, she thinks she's so smart. I think a lot of it, to be honest, is driven by passion. I mean, I'm extremely passionate about what I do. I love science. I grew up as kind of a math and science geek. I was fortunate to have had family, you know, some family linkages to the spirits industry. I've always wanted to be in the spirits industry, and I kind of landed with the dream job. But I have worked really, really hard over many years and have had so many fortunate opportunities to have my career shaped by people who also spent, you know, a lifetime in the industry and were able to share with me their knowledge and their insights. And then I was able to take that and continue on my own personal journey and continue to grow and develop. And Pam and I talk about this all the time, where we really enjoy learning and growing, and there never goes, you know, a day doesn't go by that we're not still learning new and interesting things, and it's sort of the spice of, you know, what drives us. I am a master of chemical engineering by trade. That is my actual degree.
Okay, it's really funny. We actually stayed on a vineyard property in South Australia called Yulumba, and they still have a shop where they make their own barrels.
Oh, yeah, cooperage.
They actually have a cooperage, and they said, we still keep it because our winemaker likes to fiddle around with different woods and different preparations of the barrel.
Uh-huh.
And you can't really do that when it's being made somewhere else. But here's, I have a series of questions. First question, is this 10-year-old bottle that I have, did it actually come out of a single bottle? I mean, a single barrel?
It is a single barrel product, yes. So we'll take one barrel and we process that. And every barrel is individually bottled.
Right now, so how many bottles do you get out of a barrel?
That varies. It depends on, you know, loss in the warehouse and those type of things.
Sure.
As far as numbers go, we kind of, we're a private company, so we don't really release a lot of those numbers.
Oh, okay.
But,
all right. Well, I won't be nosy then.
It varies depending on the age of the product, too. Like Andrea indicated, we do not go to the age statement that's on there. So we are tasting
to a profile. So we taste our products, and when we decide that it meets the quality parameters that we want for that particular product, like our 10-year bourbon, that is when we bottle it. So, for instance, some of our products are 12 and a half, some are 15, as much as 15 years in that 10-year bottle, as Andrea indicated earlier in the conversation.
So you're just sort of waiting for it to be just right. Now.
Exactly. I mean, we're doing it to a taste profile. We're looking for certain profiles for each one of our whiskeys, and when it attains that maturity and the tastes that we're looking for, that's when we know it's ready to bottle.
Now, here's a different question altogether, and don't throw me off. Don't throw me off the interview trail just because I'm gonna be a heretic. But what's been going on in the last 10 or 15 years in Scotland is use of different woods than were used in the past. So in the past, Scotch whiskey was made with used bourbon barrels or used cherry barrels.
Sherry.
But now they're doing all kinds of different woods.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about doing something like that with bourbon? I know it must be, it's totally the wrong thing to ask, I suppose, but I still want to ask.
No, I mean, we're always thinking outside the box. Andrea is always bringing new ideas to me. Some of the other members on the team are doing the same thing. So we have experimentation that we do, not only with wood science, but also in the distillation portion of it. My distiller, Dan McKee, is constantly innovative and trying to come up with new ideas as well. There are so many variables. Like Andrea indicated a little bit earlier, we talk about how our education continues every day. And that's because there are so many variables in the whole process of the distillery, whether it be in maturation and wood science or in the distillation portion. There are so many different things that you can change and have a different result that it's amazing. And we have done lots of experiments and we'll continue to do that. Now, some of them you might see in the market in the future. Some of them you may never see because they didn't turn out so well.
Yeah.
But that's what happens when you experiment.
So you haven't entered the market with an exotic wood yet?
No, we have done some toasted barrel products.
Got it.
Actually, I don't know if you've had any of those. We did a toasted barrel bourbon, and we also have a toasted barrel finish rye out there right now, where we take our initial rye product and we put it in a toasted only barrel for a second finish in the barrel, and it's a toasted only barrel, and it's amazing the change and the flavors that you can get by doing a finish like that in a different barrel.
I think Joe sent us one of those.
Yeah,
the bourbon, and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
He's a good guy, Joe.
It was a really fun whiskey to do because I think that, you know, part of what you're getting at with the question is that there's so many opportunities to innovate where, you know, just, under U.S. law, it calls for the utilization of new charred oak. It doesn't say anything about naturally seasoning the wood. It doesn't say anything about toasting profiles. It doesn't say anything about the type of oak that you choose. And those kinds of things offer rich opportunities, you know, for innovation. So, yeah, this one was a particularly fun one to do, though, because the toasted profile we've shared, had the opportunity to share, you know, and with different people and have an experience. And it's a whiskey that actually has a salty character to it, which, you know, your comment about Scotch, that's the only time I've ever seen that salty character. So it's just interesting, you know, how you can do something like toasting profiles that really can have a different influence on the product.
Well, you know, I'm amazed that with the perfectionism you bring to this job and the concern with quality, that you're able to produce enough to meet market demand.
Yeah, well, certainly you know, the market demand, I mean, we're still a limited production company. You know, bourbon is on fire globally. You know, certainly for the state of Kentucky, it's an $8.5 billion industry and growing all the time. It's a signature industry for us here, and there's a lot of people working really hard to make great Kentucky bourbon. We are still, I think, what I would consider, you know, a moderately sized company. We're certainly not, you know, we haven't been around for,
you know,
hundreds of years with, you know, millions of cases being sold. The heritage of our brand, we started in 1753 by a gentleman, John Schenck. We changed hands, went to Baumberger's, closed during Prohibition. And then in the 60s, we were picked up by a gentleman, Lou Foreman, who actually renamed the brand after his two sons, Michael and Peter. But then, sadly, the distillery closed in 1989 and are privately held now. And they kind of went through three different phases. The first phase was actually... Joe was being mentored by a gentleman. Is this better? So Joe was being mentored by a gentleman, Richard Dick Newman, who used to be president and CEO of Austin Nichols Wild Turkey, as well as Old Taylor and Old Crow. Had a great, career in the industry. And then he helped Joe originally go around and select some aging stocks that were of the profile that Joe wanted them to be. So he bought those casks and was able to, you know, resurrect the bottling operation. And then the second phase of their journey was to actually start producing again their mash bill, their yeast, in the new modern Michter's profile. And then the third phase was build out of a full-scale operation here in the town of Shively, which is in the city of Louisville. It's a city within the city limits of Louisville in Kentucky. And we employ over 30 people now, and we produce every bottle of Michter's, and we are very fortunate that we are, you know, the number two trending brand globally now. And it's a very exciting time for us. We've also just acquired 145 acres in Springfield, Kentucky, and we've also... the latter half of this year, we will open our consumer experience in downtown Louisville, which actually has
a
hot still from Pennsylvania. So
while,
you know, this facility here has been distilling since 2015, we don't have, you know, the stock volumes to continue to just, you know, produce anything and everything, you know, for everyone across the globe. We're being very thoughtful about how we grow our brand. We have a plan, and it all focuses around making sure that whatever we put in that bottle meets our quality standards.
Well, we're enjoying it. We're fighting over it.
Really, I don't have a chance.
Well, you'll have to make another different. You'll have to make a different one and send us a bottle of that too.
Well, I love talking to you both. I mean,
yeah,
it's just
thank you so much for joining us. It's been
have your palate insured for great sums of money.
Insured? That's a good idea. I don't know that we've thought of that yet. We'll have to bring that up to Joe.
We better let you rush off and tell him before it's too late.
Okay. Well, grand talking to you, and I keep
you
enjoying
well.
You sound like you're having a wonderful time, and I keep doing it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for having us.
Bye-bye, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, so how long do you think the bottle of Michter's is going to last?
Well, it's all yours, honey.
Well, we've had it for, probably 6 or 7 weeks now, and there's still plenty of it left.
Yeah.
But I'm rationing it myself. And I'm not to ration myself, but it's time that we just brought you a little message, and then after the message, we'll be right back. So don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, Annette Joseph is having a wonderful time. She's having a great time. I'd like to visit her. In fact, I think I said I would. She's going to talk to us about a very, very Italian
way of living. So it's like a way of life, right? Really. Certain times of the day, you got to have an
aperitivo.
And it's usually fairly late in the afternoon, but I guess if you feel like an aperitivo, you can have whatever you like.
Yeah. Her book is Cocktail Italiano, and she's going to tell us all about this whole tradition.
When we connected with the guests we're just about to interview, I said, by the way, are you the Annette Joseph who bought a fortress? and the reason for that will become very clear. It turns out that our guest is indeed the Annette Joseph who built a fort, who bought a fortress, and presumably is still in the process of renovating it, I imagine.
Yes.
But she's like an Italian lover of the first order, and spent an enormous amount of time in various parts of Italy, so much so that she decided to write this charming little book about her experiences in one particular small region of Italy where it seems about the only thing they do all day is drink.
Well, sort of.
Well, you unearthed a segment of Italian daily social life that a lot of non-Italians don't understand. So I'm counting on you and your book, Cocktail Italiano, to explain a little thing about the aperitivo culture.
Well, I mean, I wrote the book because I like to drink. No, I'm just kidding. But I do actually like a cocktail. I moved to Italy with my family 12 years ago, probably almost 13 years ago now. And we used to go in the summers all the time, and I am a food person. I, you know, wrote another book called Picture Perfect Parties, and I'm a food stylist, so I work in the food realm. And I was fascinated when we would go out for a cocktail in the evening that they would actually bring little nibbles. And I quickly learned that Italians, you know, snack when they drink and, you know, drink when they snack.
Yes.
So they really don't like to drink alcohol at all without having a little nibble. And I became fascinated with all the different kinds of little nibbles they would bring out. So sometimes it would be like a little rice dish or a little fish dish or a little cheese dish or, you know, some amazing olives or something from the seaside like sardines. And every time we would go, they would sort of concoct different things with focaccia. And so I just became really fascinated with the food stuff. So even though I like to drink, I was really fascinated by the recipes.
Well, tell me about the fried potatoes. I never got fried potatoes in Italy.
And she loves fried potatoes.
I love fried potatoes.
You mean potato chips?
Well, you said fried potatoes, I thought you said. No?
Well, they do fried sardines.
Yeah, I know. I like fried sardines.
Yeah. But really the thing about Italians is they always serve potato chips with aperitivo, which I found highly, highly amusing. And I couldn't believe it, actually. But it's a very sophisticated, you know, you can go to a very sophisticated, like the Bulgari Hotel in Milano, and they'll serve you potato chips. Granted, they're handmade potato chips, but it's like a thing. And that was very fascinating to me as well. And also the other thing that was fascinating to me is that aperitivo is really a sort of a family friends thing as well. So kids come, they eat potato chips, of course, before dinner. That's a bit, you know, my kids loved that. And ordered like, you know, a fruit juice or, you know, some sort of non-alcoholic, you know, fun little concoction with Coca-Cola or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved that. So, you know, Italians are so family oriented that, you know, it's more about the gathering and the talking than it is about anything else. And, of course, it's about the food. And then the cocktails sort of come into it somewhere along the line. And I'm a big Campari girl. And
yeah, that's what I think right away. I remember sitting in piazza after piazza with Campari, and I haven't had a Campari probably in 30 years now.
Well, maybe this book will inspire you to make yourself a Negroni or a Negroni Stagliato, which, you know, I love drinking Campari. I love, you know, Amaros have become like a thing, which I think is very funny because,
yes,
as you know, in Italy, the Amaros are usually, you know,
enjoyed by the nonnies, you know, by the grandmas and the grandpas, or the grandpa sitting in the local bar will have an Amaro, which is a bitter. But it's become sort of, Fernet has become sort of hip, which I find kind of a chuckle.
Yeah, well,
but,
I think
it, yeah, so I, you know, I love the whole idea that I'm sitting at a beach club and someone is texting me on WhatsApp saying we're all going to meet at Cafe Roma at 6:30, and you just sort of, you know, get ready and go down and sit with your friends and order a cocktail, and all these nibbles come, and before you know it, it's 8:30 in the evening, and you're trying to figure out where you're going to go for dinner, and I sort of love that, so it inspired me to write a book about it.
Now, well, you have a sort of a mixture in the if you like, the cocktail culture. You injected some American cocktail culture into the Italian cocktail culture as well.
Well, because I am very good friends with one of the top barmen in Italy. He's an older gentleman that used to work in Rome. His name is Mauro Latte, and I actually interviewed him because I wanted to find out sort of when American cocktails were introduced, because if you go and have an aperitivo anywhere on the Riviera, you're going to find a martini, you're
exactly.
going to find a gin and tonic, you're going to find all these cocktails that we know in America. And as you can imagine, in the 50s and 60s, there were a lot of American celebrities, English celebrities that would come to the Riviera, and that's sort of when the American cocktail culture was introduced in Italy. And so it went away from just having an Amaro or a bitter or some vermouth to actually having a cocktail. And it's all explained in the book, but that is where the American cocktails come from. So you can sit down anywhere on the Riviera and order a mojito.
Yeah, funny, isn't it?
Yeah, which it kind of makes sense if you sort of think back into the 1960s and all the wonderful films that were, you know, depicted in Italy. There were a lot of, you know, movie stars, and, you know, drinking martinis was very sophisticated. And, you know, Jackie O used to go to Rome all the time, and Elizabeth Taylor, and they were all real drinkers. And then where I lived in Alassio, it was full of Brits, and we have an English tennis club. We had an English Church of England was there. We had a library. We had a couple pubs. So that influence came into that town, and so ordering a gin and tonic was pretty normal because that's sort of a nice British, you know, sort of refreshing drink.
Oh,
and,
sure.
Yeah, so when you sit down anywhere now in Italy, they're very into cocktails. It's very hip right now.
I don't think I'd ever sit down.
American cocktails.
I don't think I'd ever dare order a Moscow Mule.
Oh, yeah, you can now.
I know,
absolutely, you should. The Bulgari Hotel makes a fantastic Moscow Mule. Even do some real, you know, I have some variations in the book. We went to Milano because that's one of the places that this modern aperitivo has been sort of, you know, hatched, and they've come up with these amazing cocktails. Like they do a twist on an Aperol Spritz with wasabi and balsamico.
Now, we stayed at the Bulgari, the only time I've ever been in Milan.
Oh, it's beautiful, and it has a great bar, and the bar is featured in the book as well, as are their cocktails, and they're all very, very continental.
Why don't we go back there? I forgot about that.
it has a wonderful restaurant, too.
Yes.
We interviewed the owner of the restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
We had a beautiful lunch, and then we interviewed the owner.
But cocktails are big, like even in Villa della Pergola, which is in Alassio, which was Condé Nast, one of their top 50 boutique hotels. They do their own spin on the Aperol Spritz, you know. So it's become, you know, aperitivo has become a very sort of current thing. And you'll find all the classic American, classic Italians, but also some spins on those as well, some twists.
Now, you include a lot of food with your, and we already said you were a foodie, and I agree with you. The only civilized way to drink alcohol is with food.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right. I agree with you.
Yeah. But did you pick the food according to the regions you're covering? Because you do cover certain regions.
Well, we only cover one region, which is Liguria. The only exception is we go to Milano, because Milano and Turin were two places that they've sort of modernized aperitivo and made it more what they call a aperitacena, which means dinner. So they've got heavier hors d'oeuvres with their cocktails. But really, it's one region. It's Liguria, which is the Italian Riviera. It starts in Bordighera, which is near the French border, and you drive all the way down towards Genova, which is also on the Riviera, and then you make a sharp downward turn south, and you end up and finally in Porto Venere, which is right where Liguria ends and Tuscany begins. So it really is just one region. We go from town to town. In each town, I have enjoyed aperitivo at all these places.
Yeah.
I happen to be friends with most of the owners. And
I love that, how you talked about how you knew all the bartenders.
Yeah, well, I like to have fun, and I've lived there for 12 years. And I also have lots of girlfriends that live in these different towns, and lots of, you know, our friends live there, so they know all these owners of these different places. So I had really nice introductions. But a lot of these, like, for example, in Bordighera at La Reserve, which is an unbelievably beautiful place to have aperitivo, and it doesn't hurt that the owner is super handsome, but we got his recipe for, they do these beautifully sort of deep fried, very delicate carrots and onions and calamari.
Yeah, I noticed that already.
Yeah, and that is a great recipe. And so, you know, I mean, just eating that and, you know, drinking a lovely cocktail while, you know, viewing the ocean and the cliffs, and people are sort of cliff diving as you're drinking your drink. It's just a really nice way to spend the late afternoon, early evening. So personally, I have personally checked out all these places. You literally can take this book with you and put it in your suitcase, and you can go from bar to bar, because in the back I've got every single bar listed and all their addresses and all their websites. And you can do like an aperitivo tour if you wanted to.
And it's going to give good information to people who want to get off the tourist trail.
Exactly.
Yes.
And the other thing is, the book is also filled with all sorts of, you know, information about, for example, a lot of people are very confused about the beach clubs on the Riviera.
Oh, right.
Like, can I go in? Is it a private club?
Yeah.
And all of the beach clubs you can go into. You don't have to lay on the beach. You can just go in and have a cocktail and enjoy, you know, the sunbathers or whatever, or lunch. And so I give people real, you know, real information about how to not be a tourist and how to feel comfortable on the Riviera and what the rules are as far as when to aperitivo and where to aperitivo. So it's full of really good information as well.
Now,
if you're traveling along the Riviera, which I highly suggest.
Now, are the beaches sand or are they shingle?
Well, the beaches in on the Riviera, for the most part, are sand.
Oh, good. Okay.
So, which is unusual in Italy, because a lot of times, like in, you know, people are very surprised when they go to like Capri, or as we say, Capri, and there it's all, you know, sort of rocks that you're laying on. Very upsetting.
Well, Nice and Cannes and all those towns on the
Nice
French Riviera were a huge disappointment to us the first time we went there, because you had to keep your shoes on to be able to walk on the beach because it was all shingle.
Yeah. No. And as a matter of fact, some of, like, for example, Bordighera has a huge sandy beach. It has a beautiful boardwalk. If you read the book, it tells you where the sandy beaches are. Between Portofino and Santa Margherita is one of my favorite little beach clubs. It's teeny tiny, but it's so charming. And there's actually a book written about that beach club called Portofino. It's an old book. But there's some really beautiful sandy beaches all along the coastline. As you go further south, they become less sandy. Alassio has a huge sandy beach. One of my, you know, favorite beaches is Veragotti Beach, which no one knows about, and it's not actually in the book. But it is one of the most glorious sandy beaches, and it's like being in Sardinia. It's really beautiful. So you can find them along the Riviera. And it's part of the reason we picked Alassio to live in is because it has one of the biggest, widest, sandiest beaches.
Now this is a warning sign. You won't find this in this book, except you'll find veiled reference to a place called Cinque Terre, which is close by. and if you like German tourists, please go there.
Cinque Terre has done a very good job marketing itself, so you've got to give it some credit. You know, Tuscany's the same way. If you don't want to see Americans, then come to where we live now in Lunigiana. There's very few tourists. There are barely any American tourists there, barely. I mean, when we see an American in our piazza, we're like, oh, my gosh, where are they from? It's like aliens. But Cinque Terre was very, very beautiful at one point, and then they marketed it, and now they're suffering just like Venice is, where, you know, there's wear and tear, and they have to repair things. And I will say that people, I live 40 minutes from there, and I never go there. There are so many other little towns, like, you know, near us that are so, like, Lerici is fantastic. And I write about Lerici, and there's the most fantastic hotel to hang out at that is right up the road that I write about, called Eco del Mare. And it's absolutely spectacular. I mean, you feel like you're on another planet. It's so beautiful. We have a tendency to, you know, have the inside scoop. And with this book, I've given you a little bit of an inside scoop. Right. But Cinque Terre is not there.
Portofino is as beautiful as they say it is.
Portofino is really wonderful. It's one of those places. It's teeny tiny, but it's very chic, and it's very fun to have aperitivo there. And Bar Gritti has been there forever,
right.
And it's super fun people watching. It's really a people watching place, and you watch these giant, you know, yachts like pull into these teeny tiny slips, and it's very jet setter, but it's very charming. And Santa Margarita, which is right down the road, like about a mile and a half down the road, is absolutely a fabulous town, and it is the very first town that we ever rented a house, and it's quite spectacular. We really wanted to buy a house there, but because Italians pass their houses down from family to family to family, mm-hmm. it's very hard to find something there.
Yeah, and you better actually be very fluent in Italian when you sign your documents.
Well, you know, this is what we say. You know, we bought two properties in Italy, and in America, it's very different. In Italy, when you go into a property, the first question that you ask in Italy is, how many people own this property?
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
Yeah. So if it's under five, you have a pretty good chance of getting it.
Oh, you are funny.
But if it's over 15, it's probably not going to happen.
Oh,
so you need
wonderful.
To walk out.
That's wonderful information.
Well, I'm actually writing another book called Italy is My Boyfriend, where I go into all of this real estate stuff.
Oh, well, it's funny. I mean, I've known people who, architects who have been hoodwinked and buying property.
Yes, you have to be very savvy and you have to be extremely connected. I say that in Italy, you really have to have juice. And, you know, in America, they say, oh, you need juice. No, in Italy, you really need to have juice. Like, you have to be in the family, you know. You really have to be taken in by someone and really shown the ropes. Otherwise, you can definitely take a bath, as they say.
Well, you've inspired us. We will go back to the Italian Riviera. We will bypass La Spezia. We will bypass.
Oh, that's bad.
We will bypass.
Well, no. Now, wait a minute. I live near La Spezia, and I will tell you that I grocery shop in La Spezia. And La Spezia is a very cool place, but you have to know where to go. It's like Genoa. You know, Genoa is one of those places where Americans go and think, oh, my God, this is so industrial. But Genoa is unbelievably fascinating place. I love it. And it's one of my favorite cities in Italy and one of the most overlooked.
It's a port city. I mean, all those port cities have so many different sides to them and undersides to them.
You have to come with me to La Spezia. I will take you there and I'll change your mind. I'm going to take you to a fish place that's going to blow your mind.
All right. You're on, Annette Joseph.
What I need is Annette Joseph to blow my mind. There's no question about it.
Well, come to you. Make sure to let me know when you're there, and I will do just that.
And when do you go? Summer?
Yeah, I leave in May 16th. I'm going to be there, and then I'll be there until Halloween. Because we conduct workshops. I do photo styling workshops and painting workshops.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we do workshops at the fortress, and people come stay. And
well, I was going to say, do you have rooms and things?
We do. We have like 9 bedrooms, and it's over 10,000 square feet. We have our own vineyard, so we make our own wine, and we're on 27 acres. So we have a very big property there that we enjoy and have been renovating for the past 2 years.
Fine.
Oh,
we'll stop by on the way to Piemonte.
We have room for you. We have room. No problem.
No, we'll stay there on the way to Piemonte. It's sort of not too far out of the way.
It's not that bad. It's probably a nice 3-hour drive.
Great. Well,
what
you.
Was my book I was going to write?
Centro et Uni Lumaki.
Until somebody convinced me that nobody was interested in snails, and now they're having a revival, right?
I thought it was so clever after 1001 Dalmatians, but and in degree anyway. So I'm glad we didn't do it. But that's a story for another day. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And again, the book is Cocktail Italiano, and it's Annette Joseph, who is a delight, and I can't wait to come and stay with you, Annette.
Yep. You've got it. I mean, okay. You guys have your room. I have your room ready for you.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
You guys take care. It was really fun.
Ciao.
Okay, ciao.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
You know, if I had really said the word out loud, I might have figured out the reference, the Garagista Festival. Really, it's you heard of garage bands? Well, this started as a reference to garage wines. Let's let Doug Minnick explain this festival.
And if you ever wanted to know why garage wines are called garage wines, you're going to find that out too.
Well, I'm just set about learning something today. I'm talking to Doug Minnick about the Garagista Wine Festival. And my first question, Doug, is what in the world is this?
The Garagista Wine Festival is a festival that we have been producing. We are in our eighth year now that gathers and celebrates micro wineries. These are wineries who produce less than 1,500 cases a year, which is tiny in the grand scheme of the wine industry. And the great majority of the wineries that we have at our festivals do not have tasting rooms and are not on the wine country maps.
Oh, good,
and
good.
Are a little bit hard to find. So we've found them, and we bring them together for these festivals, which we do four times a year. We started in Paso Robles, California. We go to
San
Ynez.
We've been there. We know those wine guys.
Oh, yeah. That's where we started 8 years ago. And then San Ynez, and we do one in Los Angeles. And now we're going up to Sonoma on May 12th for our first time in Sonoma.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so this is the first time in the midst of genuine, big-time California winery country, right?
Yeah. Yes, we had a lot of Sonoma winemakers Sonoma and Napa winemakers who knew about the festival and have been asking us to come up there, and so we're doing it.
Now, do you actually have an association, or is it just a mailing list, or is it just a group of guys who hang out together?
Well, it's like an organization. We're not structured that way. We are a nonprofit. We're a 501c3. We actually raised funds for a scholarship fund at Cal Poly University here in San Luis Obispo. So we have a scholarship fund that goes to deserving young winemakers, aspiring winemakers. I guess they don't have to be young. And so we raise money for that. And when we started off, my partner Stuart McLennan and I, when we started off 8 years ago, we knew a lot of these small winemakers, and we started there. And we had about 40 wineries at our first event. And since that time, we now have about over 500 wineries that have poured with us or involved with us in some way, and that's all over the state of California and beyond, really.
Yeah, they're wonderful people. I mean, these winemakers, when we were in Paso Robles, and we had, the Rhone Rangers, and we had some ex-NFL football player producing
Terry
wine.
Hogue.
Who?
Yeah, Terry Hogue, I'll bet.
Yes, it was Terry Hogue, and we had a big party. and we did an interview, and everybody talked about, you know, it was wonderful. We had so much fun.
No,
they're very warm and welcoming people. It's funny that people think of the wine business or the wine world as snobby somehow, and maybe you get some of that from sommeliers and restaurants or something. I don't know, but when it comes to the winemakers themselves, there's almost none of that. They're just fun people doing what they love to do. They love to tell their story, and that's one of the things about the festival is that we have at the Garage East Festival only the winemakers themselves pour their wines at the festival. So it's not salespeople or brokers. It's the winemakers, and they really enjoy it, and they really do love meeting the people who come to the festival and telling their stories and sharing their wine. And it's, you know, our unofficial motto is no snobs allowed. And it's a fun place without being an overcrowded drunk fest.
Now, I'm going to show my ignorance. What does Garage East mean?
Garage East is a word that originated in France in the Bordeaux. So the story goes that Robert Parker touring the Bordeaux back in, I don't know if it was the 70s or what, but that he was visiting one of the big chateaus and tasting their wine, and he mentioned to them that he had seen another winemaker down the road and was thinking about going down there to try their wine, and the people in the big chateau haughtily dismissed them as, you don't want to go down there, they're just garagistes, and meaning they were working in their garage. And so it was meant as an insult and a dismissal, and Parker went down, story goes, and their wine was great, and time has gone by, and the word has now been flipped to be sort of a badge of honor for artisans who are doing things their own way. In France, there's these very strict rules, AOC rules, about, you know, how you can produce your wine, and you know, what varietals you can use, and what percentage, and when they're picked, and et cetera, et cetera. And the original garagistes, so the story goes, were not paying any attention to those rules. They were maybe picking later, or you know, just doing things the way they wanted to do it. And so that's what the term has come to mean, is renegades, rule breakers, people blazing their own trail.
Fun.
Now, why did you and Stuart, your partner, why did you specifically decide that this was something that you ought to do?
Well, we knew that we knew a lot of these winemakers in Paso and in the Santa Barbara area, and no one had ever, you know, brought them together. Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it was the wine we like to drink, and we saw an opportunity here to be able to drink the wine we like and call it work. So first and foremost, it was a practice.
An honest man.
but no one had gathered them, and, you know, sort of put an umbrella over it and shined a spotlight on the movement. So we thought that would be a fun thing to try. We didn't have any idea when we first started what we had. We didn't really know. We figured there were some people out there that would enjoy the same wines that we did, but we didn't know how many, and we were shocked, really, to find out just how popular it became and how quickly, and that's why we've, you know, expanded it to 4 festivals now and all up and down the state, because it's really turned out to be a popular thing.
Now, we were in Paso for about a week several years ago, and we found a group there called the Rhone Rangers.
Yeah, I just mentioned them.
What's the difference between the Rhone Rangers and the Garagistes?
Well, we have a lot of overlap. There's some overlap because a lot of the people that pour at Garagistes also, you know, make Rhone wines, and some of them are also members of the Rhone Rangers. We're very friendly with the Rhone Rangers. The difference, I would say, between what we're doing and the Rangers, and really any other sort of trade organization, most trade organizations are centered either around a region or a particular varietal or varietals. You know, there's the Cab Collective or the Rhone Rangers, there's the World of Pinot Noir, there's you know, and then there's, of course, the local, festivals and organizations that focus on an area, you know, Paso or Santa Barbara or whatever it is. Garagiste is unique in that our only organizing principle is that the winemakers are small. And this means that you get the widest possible variety of wines to try at the festival and from anywhere. And that really does make it a unique event, because none of the winemakers that pour at the Garagiste Festival, working at this level of production, are making wines for the supermarket. These are not supermarket wines. They're not made for the marketplace really at all. These are winemakers who are making the wine they want to make, that they want to drink, that they're passionate about. And we believe strongly that this makes for the most interesting and best wine out there. And so we have varietals at our festivals that are, you know, that I'm still finding new stuff, even after all this time, new varietals that I've never tried. Have you ever heard of a grape called Symphony?
I have not. Now, let's help our listeners out here, for those who are not aficionados as much as we are. A varietal is, if you like, a variety of grape.
Correct. Yes, so a Pinot Noir is type of grape, a Cabernet Sauvignon, a Syrah, a Chardonnay. These are all grapes, and those are the most well-known ones. And there's so many more. And again, you'll never see a Tannat, for example, on the shelf at a supermarket, because you know the wines you find on a supermarket are made by big producers, and they're not going to bother with a niche product like a Tannat. But these small winemakers, they don't care. They make what they want to make, and then next order of business is then trying to find an audience for it. And that's where we help them. We bring them an audience of people who enjoy finding these kinds of discoveries.
Oh, great.
What's Gary's last name, the guy we know?
Eberle.
Gary Eberle.
Oh, yeah.
You know Gary?
Sure.
He talks about the suitcase clone of Syrah that he introduced into California.
Yep.
and the name is indicative of how it got there. So
yep.
I'm guessing a lot of these varietals travel around the world the same way.
Yeah, I know a story. I guess the guy who told the story shall remain nameless, but there were some Spanish varietals that he wanted to bring in, and he was in Spain. The way they do it is they take cuttings off of the vine.
Yeah, right.
And, exactly. And so he took these cuttings of these Spanish varietals, and there's a whole system, I guess, you have to go through a quarantine, and, it's very, very restrictive what you can, moving plant material around like that, or agricultural material. So he wrapped them up in T-shirt or something, and said these were barbecue sticks. He was bringing home some barbecue sticks from Spain, and they said, "Okay, well, that seems harmless enough." And off he went. And now there's Spanish varietals being planted in the Paso area.
Yeah, I guess people will take a crack at anything. Although the guys there seem heavily focused on Pinot Noir. That's the grape they love the best, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of great Pinot being grown on the Central Coast. Wonderful thing about the Central Coast is, if you kind of look at the whole thing, from 30,000 feet, is that you can do anything. There's so many different little microclimates that you can grow any grape in any and produce it in any style that you wish. And I can't think of any other region in the world that you can say that about. And so that's what you've got. You've got a lot of winemakers that are doing very adventurous things because of the conditions that allow it. And it has really become a rich and exciting world of wine out here.
What's the winemaker, California winemaker, that wrote the all his ad material, like the Divina Commedia.
Oh.
He was, what's his name?
Why can't I remember? Kent Randall Graham.
Randall Graham.
Oh, right.
Well,
yeah,
he's setting out to develop a whole new grape.
Right. Yes, he is. That's, see, there you go. That's certainly ambitious.
Yes.
It's not really nutty, just acts like it is.
Yeah, I mean, he's crazy like a fox. But,
yes.
There are so many stories out there. The story of the Cone Vineyard, where the guy was selling all his grapes, and then he made a little bit on the side for himself, and everybody said you ought to sell more of this, and he said well I can't ship my grapes too far because August Sebastiani will see me doing it and he won't buy any more of my fruit. So somebody told him that August tended to go to bed fairly early, so if he waited until after dark, he'd probably be all right. And that's how B.R. Cohn's Cabernet Sauvignon got made.
They're great, interesting people. I mean, we've met so many winemakers that are fun.
Who's the characters? Who's the side of the Rhone Rangers guy? They're partnered with the parent people from Chateauneuf du Pape. But he's
thinking of Jason Haas from the Haas family from Tablas Creek.
Yeah, Tablas Creek. That's it exactly. Tablas Creek.
Yes. And yeah, they have. They have Tablas Creek in Paso, and their family also owns, I think it's Chateau Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N. I think I have that right. I may not. In France.
Well, that's the family name of the.
Or Perrin de Beaucastel, or yeah.
Beaucastel. Like anyway. Beaucastel yeah. is their, that's their top Chateauneuf du Pape wine.
Right. So they have that bridge, that very direct bridge between France and Paso.
What they told us, interestingly enough, Doug, was that the parents did a search around the United States. I think maybe it was further afield than that, to try to find out the place that had the perfect climate to be able to grow the kind of Pinot Noir grapes that they wanted to produce. And Paso Robles was the area they selected.
Yep, and they were among the first there. Yeah. I think Gary Eberle is another one who was, I think I've heard, was the first to make Syrah out there. And
that's the suitcase clone. That's the suitcase clone.
We just have a gazillion stories from all these people.
I just have one more question. Aside from, before we forget when we sign off, let's record in here the URL for the Garage East group, especially the event in Sonoma.
Okay, good. Thank you for remembering that. So you can find us at GarageEastFestival.com. So GARAGIESTE Festival.com. GarageEastFestival.com. And we have a free newsletter that you can sign up for from anywhere. And then you'll get first notice when we're doing new events, or we have news, or we have discounts that we offer for tickets, or whatever the case may be. But if you sign up for the newsletter, you'll be connected to us.
I had another question, because depending on what part of the world you're in, some people only grow grapes, other people only make wine, but don't grow grapes. Is there any kind of boundary in the Garage East that fits into that kind of categorization, that I'm buying grapes from five or six different plots that I know very well, and I don't grow a single grape?
Yeah, it's a great question. Because for myself as a winemaker, it was 20 years ago or so, and I had the epiphany. I said, oh, geez, I'd love to live in wine country. I'd love to have a vineyard and make wine.
Uh-huh.
boy, that's impossible. And then one day I realized, wait a minute, you don't have to own any land at all. You don't have to own any vineyards. You can source your fruit. And so many of the garagistes do. We have people who own their own vineyards as well. But a lot of the garagistes do source fruit. And what that allows you to do is, well, it gives you a lot of freedom. You know, you're not tied to any one vineyard and whatever takes place in that vineyard, be it weather or yield or whatever else might happen. You can search around and target specific vineyards that you would like to get your fruit from. And it gives you a real freedom to experiment and expand.
So they both categories exist in the people who go to the garagistes festivals and who are part of your
Correct.
Group?
Yes. We have both the winemakers who are growers and winemakers who are not growers. A lot of the winemakers who pour at garagistes have a day job as a winemaker at a larger winery.
Yeah, that I've heard of too.
You know, many, many very, very well-known wineries, and this is their personal project, their side project. These are all commercial winemakers now, just to be clear. These are not hobbyists, far from it.
Right.
This is, in my opinion, some of the best wine being made in the country right now. But again, as I said, these are personal passion projects. So they're, you know, they may be making, you know, very unusual grapes or unusual styles or just doing what they love to do. And while they are working for other wineries.
You know, we had fun when we were at the Melbourne Australia Food and Wine Festival. They had an event called the First Families of Australian Wines. And these people were like the fourth generation of winemakers in Australia. And they poured some of the great gems of their production.
Mm. Yeah, we
love that.
Yeah, we got invited to one of their events, and the requirement of the participating wineries. Now, these were all sizable wineries because
they're big. You know, yeah, the First Family. Right.
But they were to bring library wines.
Hmm.
It was fun.
It was a whole lot of fun. I bet garagistes wines don't get into too many libraries. Huh?
I guess not.
Well. It depends. You know, there's certainly not a lot of them. I know there's a lot of the garagistes wineries are the kinds of wineries that sell out their production to their allocation list. So
Got
people
it.
Sign
sure,
up,
sure, sure.
And then it's gone. You know, so this is another reason to come to the festival is that you find these wineries early. We have, let me look this up here. 7 wineries in Sonoma that are pouring their first vintage. So
we're going to
have 40 wineries there. 7 are pouring their first vintage. We have one that's only that's producing sparkling wine. And so when you find them early like this, it's fun. It's you know, I'm an old music business guy, and I used to spend a lot of time in the clubs scouting for bands and musical artists, There's a certain thrill about finding someone early in the clubs before they have a hit record and then watching them succeed. The same thing is true in this way, that you can find winemakers early, you meet them, you feel like a part of their success in a way, and you are, you know, because you got onto it early and you helped support them, and you can get on these allocation lists while you still can. You know, so many of them, their allocation lists fill up, and that's it. They can't take any more people, so
right. You have to
get on a waiting list.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today.
Doug, this was nice talking
please,
to you.
Please give our best wishes to your partner, Stuart McLennan, who we understand is on radio now, so on his own show, so he can't join us. But I'll bet you'll have a good time in Sonoma, and if somehow or other we can find our way onto your schedule of events, who knows? We might be able
to show up.
We'd love to have you out. This one is May 12th. It's the day before Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. So we're telling all mothers out there that take the whole weekend for yourself, and you can come taste wine on Saturday and then go out to brunch with the family on Sunday or whatever you want to do. Yeah. But uh, it's uh, it's going to be a fun weekend.
Well, here's cheers to you, Doug. Thank you so much for being
all those mothers out there.
That's right. Thank you, Ann and Peter.
Doug, ciao.
So anyway, guys, just in case you missed it, the Garage East Wine Festival in Sonoma, California is on Mother's Day. So if you didn't buy anything for Mother yet, now's your chance. And in the meantime, since we're out of time for today's program, let's just say until next week.
Bye-bye.